Before I begin, I just want to tell you, what I'm giving out for you, so you know where my sources come from. The Hebrew comes from a book called Nishmas Avram, and this is a compilation of tshuvas, of responsa, on halachic issues that deal with medical complications, medical questions. And this book, which is a great book, is authored by Avram Sofer, otherwise known as Steinberg, and this is a great work. The English that I gave out comes from a journal which is called Halacha and Contemporary Society, and that's published by the RJJ School, Rabbi Jacob Joseph School. And this article was authored by the editor of that journal. His name is Rabbi Alfred Cohen. Those who come from Brooklyn, or if you're a graduate of MTA, you'll know who he is. He's one of the senior rabbeim at MTA Yeshiva University High School. So he wrote an entire essay on artificial insemination. Now, I'm ready to begin. Are there any questions before I begin? Maybe you want to tell me, you know, what you know about artificial insemination, or maybe you want to share with me your interest in this topic. Whatever you'd like. If not, I'll just start.
Sorry, I don't know where she is. She left her.
She uses the washroom, and then she'll come back. Oh. Don't worry. I mean, I'm going to take her home later, so she can't go too far without.
Okay. So.
Okay.
Fine.
Right. Okay. So let's get started. This issue, which is not brand new, is an issue which I think you could say has gone through what I call a metamorphosis. Meaning there's the older tshuvas, the older responsa, and then there's the newer tshuvas. And it really changes from one extreme to the other. If you turn back the clock, let's say 60, 70 years ago, almost all the responsa were machmir. They were very negative, and I'll tell you why. They came to the conclusion that there's no way that you can allow this to go on. And it only became more of a, shall I say, a flexible possibility to permit artificial insemination after Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote his responsa. Now, when Rav Moshe wrote his responsa, which goes back 40 years ago, it created a tremendous, for those of you who may remember, kicked up a tremendous controversy. I mean, usually in halachic debates, you know, there's a certain amount of eloquent, you know, gentlemen, you know, you say you are, I disagree. There's no anger. It's just like Israeli politics. There's no anger whatsoever. Right? It's all eloquent and men, you know, menschle. But in this particular debate or controversy, things got really out of hand. I mean, it became like a world, you know, world war. The reason for that is because the issue is so sensitive in halacha. You know, when you're dealing with what we call yuchsin, you know, to figure out who's the father, and you want to talk about taking the sperm of a donor and giving it to a woman who's married, you know, this is a very severe issue that touches on the whole structure of Jewish family life. I mean, you know, we have so many statements in Chazal that the greatness of the Jewish people is that they have a pure lineage. And they know exactly, you know, who the father is. You know, that's what we boast, and God chose us because of that reason. And now you're going to tamper with that because you're going to introduce some foreign donor and go figure out who the donor is. And there was a meshiv, someone who wrote tshuvas way back when, almost 100 years ago. He was called the Divrei Malkiel, and he was totally opposed to this. in the more contemporary history, not 100 years ago, but let's say 50 years ago, there was a meshiv by the name of Rav Breisch from Switzerland, one of the great poskim of the 20th century, and he too came out in total opposition of the possibility of artificial insemination. And again, we'll see why. And this led up to an exchange of letters with the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish, as you know, about 50 years ago, we're not going back so far in history, he was the final decisor, the posek for all of Eretz Yisrael. And he said there's no way, no how that we can talk about artificial insemination. So as I say, the turning point in this whole issue is when Rav Moshe Feinstein and Igros Moshe published the Tshuva, in which he had a more lenient approach. Now, keep in mind, it's not at all clear that Rav Moshe actually ever permitted it. In other words, there's no situation in history that we know of in which Rav Moshe actually said, go ahead with artificial insemination. All the writings of Rav Moshe, all the tshuvas, and there are many tshuvas in Rav Moshe about artificial insemination, they're all written on a very theoretical basis. You know, what would the halacha say about it? So let's talk about some of the issues that brought so much, you know, anger and so much emotion against a permissible, more liberal approach on this topic. The first issue is what's called hashchasas zera. What that means is that the Torah is opposed with a very severe violation of wasting man's seed. And what this means is the Torah allows for man to deposit his seed, so to speak, in a sexual union. That's the normal way you do it. And that's considered kiteva or kiderecha olam. And that's the way a man fulfills his obligation of periuvirivya, of multiplying. If you remove man's sperm outside of a union between a man and a woman, which is not kidarko shalolam, that's called hashchasa zera. So as I mentioned to you 100 years ago already, the Direi Malkiel, again, he was talking about the theoretical possibility of such a scientific technique. It was really just what should I say? It was a dream that this could ever actually come into reality. It was all theoretical, and he said, first and foremost, you know, you don't even have to. This is not an issue to discuss because this is a violation of a severe iser of hashchasas zera. Now, if you have the Hebrew pages that I gave you. And again, I'm not saying that this is very sophisticated, this piece from the Nishmas Avram.
Who was the Nishmas Avram?
His name is Rav Avram Steinberg. And he writes on page Yud Beis, which is the flip side of your page, in a paragraph that starts on the bottom of the right column, he says, I put a little arrow there, I don't know if it came out in the photocopy, she'enze, four lines up from the bottom, enze begeder hashchasa. That artificial insemination is not a violation of wasting seed. Hashchasa means to waste something. When it goes li'ibud, it goes for naught. And again, he's arguing against many, many responsa on this topic that came before him. Who is it? Again, keep in mind, the Nishmas Avram is only an anthology. Who is he quoting here? Who is the first heroic meshiv, the first heroic breakthrough response before Rav Moshe Feinstein? And this was a Glitziana posek in the city of Berjan, who was called the Marsham. The Marsham. Again, his town sounds a little similar to my last name, but it's not the same. Mine is Berzon, his is Berjan. He was the Berjan of Rav. He was a tremendous posek and decided many issues. And he says that there's no violation here of Hashchasa Zera. And why not? He says because Hazera lo yelech liivud ulavatola. This is not a waste of seed. The purpose of this procedure is to impregnate a woman and have a child. This is the only way that he can fulfill his mitzvah. Now again, we're now in what I call Roman numeral number one. Roman numeral number one, in Hebrew we call it Shlav Aleph, is a discussion about taking the husband's seed through this process of artificial insemination and injecting it into a woman's, his wife's womb, and she becomes pregnant from her husband's seed. If that be the case, I wouldn't call it artificial insemination. I would call it technological insemination. But it's not artificial. It's very real. It's really insemination. All you're doing is you're finding a different technique instead of a sexual union. But it's really the same. It's identical. And the zera of the husband is going to meet up with the ovum of his wife, and hence she will conceive a child. Now keep in mind that the Marsham was faced with the following question. A couple were married for 10 years and they couldn't have children. Now, we have to know a little bit about the significance of this 10-year period. It's not just an arbitrary case. The halacha says that if a man has an obligation to have children, to procreate, period merivia, and he hasn't been able to fulfill that mitzvah even after 10 years of marriage, that's reason to divorce his wife. So what we're trying to salvage here is not just period verivia, we're trying to find a way of saving the marriage. And this is very desperate. Now, when we talk about the word desperate, desperate can mean many different things. First of all, it means a halachic desperation, because halachically, at this point, he's really desperate. He is on the verge of having a marriage collapse. And that's not something that the Torah wants to see. But on an emotional level, it's a whole different story. There's a desperation here, an anguish. And you and I know how deep and profound is the anguish of a couple that can't have children. Now, if the physicians say that there's nothing wrong with his zera, there's nothing wrong with her ovum, it's just that the method by which the conception will take place is impossible, and therefore in a normal natural union it won't happen, but we can take the zera out of the body of the man and inject it into the woman's uterus, and as a result conception will take place, says the Marsham, that's not wasting seed, that's using the seed exactly for what it's meant to be. But then he says the following, well, how much of the seed do we need for this? A lot of the seed is going to go to waste outside of a woman's body. So it's really Hautzah Zera Levatola. He says, no, that's not Hautzah Zera Levatola. If it's done for the intention of fulfilling this great mitzvah period of Arivia, then that's not wasted seed. If this is the procedure that has to be implemented in order to achieve the goal, that's not considered waste. And he gives other examples in halacha where the Torah says it all depends on what your intention is. There are cases in which, for example, a person hits somebody, and that's a violation of a Torah law. But if he hits him for a positive purpose, let's say medicinally, or he's operating on a person, that's not a violation of law. It all depends on what the intention is. Or, for example, there's halacha of mechikas Hashem, which is a terrible sin when you erase the name of God. But let's say you do it for a purpose, not because you want to obliterate the name of God. That's okay. So, for example, we're going to allow a physician to operate on his own parent, even though that's a violation of wounding a parent, that's a capital crime. But if it's done not for the sake of destruction, but for the sake of physical health, that's not a violation. So here, the Hotzah Zera is not going for the sake of Hashchosas Zera, but rather for the sake of Tikkun, for the sake of impregnating a woman and having a child. Now, despite the fact that the Marsham was convinced of the logic of his argument, he adds 2 points. Number one, I'm only allowing it, I'm only going to permit it, in a case of a couple that tried to get to have a baby for 10 years. And that means that halakhically, he's at the verge of divorce. Secondly, he says, I'm not going to allow it unless two other rabbis will agree to my psak. In other words, he's so aware of the fact that this is a breakthrough in redefining Hashkasa Zera, which is a very severe violation, that he needs the support of two other rabbis. Well, guess what? He got the support of tons of rabbis. The first one to support him was the Har Tzvi, Rav Hirsch Pesach Frank, he was the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. The second one to support him was the Minchas Yitzchak, the head of the Badatzir, the Eda Haredes. The third one was the Zkan Aaron, Rav Aaron Volkin. He was a Rav in Lita, in Lithuania. And then after that, all the modern poskim jumped on the bandwagon. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Rav Avad Yosef, the Sri Deish, if you ever heard of her, Weinberg, one of the survivors of the Holocaust. They all came to the support of the Marsham, and they said that he's right. This is not called Hashkasa Zera. This is being done and implemented for the greater good of having a child. Now, even the Marsham, as we said before, was very hesitant. And he wanted to get, you know, some cavalry, you know, some other poskim to agree with him and bolster his position. The reason why he was hesitant is because there's so much dependence upon the physician. Now, normally, when you go through a medical procedure, you have full faith in the physician that he's going to try to do the best he can to heal you. That's reasonable. However, in this particular case of artificial insemination, you really have to rely on the physician for many different, you know, for answers to many different questions. For example, you have to rely on the physician to guarantee you that the zera, the sperm here, is exclusively the sperm of the husband. Because keep in mind, this physician is being paid, and hopefully he's getting hopefully from his perspective, at least he's getting paid a handsome sum in order to achieve a goal. So he has a definite goal. Now he realizes that if he mixes in more sperm, then he increases the chances of success. So he has vested interest here in fooling around, you know what I mean, and not doing exactly what he should do. We don't have any way of guaranteeing that the physician is reliable. So if you turn back to page Yud Aleph, which is the flip side of the Hebrew page, and you'll see here on the right side, he quotes the Diri Malkiel. That's the original responsa that was written on this topic. He says the following: how could he rely on the Rofe, on this physician? The Rofe is claiming that he's going to take all the zera collected and inject it into the woman's uterus. Do we rely on him? How do we know he's going to do a good job? How do we know he's not going to add other zera? Can we trust the physician? For example, there's a shoferes. The zera is put into a tube. Well, you know, did anyone check the shoferes? The person himself who's coming for the treatment, he's going to be too embarrassed to check the shoferes to see if there's not something in that tube. Maybe there's already, you know, there's already zera there from someone else. And he goes on to quote various sources that we always, when it comes to relying on someone, especially a non-Jew, he doesn't really have credibility. We need some sort of system in which we can absolutely guarantee that he's telling us the truth. Again, if we had more time, I would discuss the case of what's called a kfela, meaning a chef, that if we have a mixture of milk and meat, we give it to a chef and we rely on him to tell us whether there's a taste of the milk and the meat. And why do we rely on him? Because we can test him out. If he tells us X, then we can find out that it's really Y and he lied to us. So for example, you know, milk, you know, how do we know that they didn't add non-kosher milk? The answer is we can test them out. You know, we have something over them.
However reliable the computer is, I just saw a case where they found out through DNA. DNA can test whether
it was a doctor.
It turned out the kids, that was not the father. It was not the father. They found out through DNA, so there is a way of
Right, but not at the time of the Diri Malkiel. You know, you're going back like 80, 90 years
ago. Very recently, a couple of weeks ago, it was in the news.
It was in the news. Okay, let's assume that we can solve two problems, and that's what the Marashab is trying to do. Number one, we can solve the problem of Hotzah Zera. We can say it's not Levatol, it's not Lashchosa, because it's for the sake of a Tikkun, and it has a purpose. Number two, we can somehow rely on the Rofe. We could check out this tube beforehand. We'll subject, you know, we'll psych him out, and now we have DNA testing. We'll be able to clarify that. What are some of the other issues? Well, first we have to know why this woman is not becoming pregnant. I mean, she has eggs, she has ovum, he has sperm. What's the problem? One of the issues that might come up is the Nida issue, meaning that her cycle is such that she ovulates during a period of time which overlaps with her Nidus. What do you mean? Because Nidus is not just when a woman sees blood. Nidus extends for a whole long period of time beyond that. Like, for example, she can't begin to count Zayin Nikim until after 5 days go by. So this is going to extend her period of Nidus. Now, very often, the Hazra Malachutit, this artificial insemination, has to be done during a time when she's still in Nida. She hasn't gone to Mikveh yet. With a child, therefore, that's conceived as a result of this artificial insemination during a period of ovulation, which coincides with her Nidas, be the child of a Nida. Now, again, the child of a Nida is not such a terrible thing. But it is what's called a pagam. You know, it's not something that we're excited about. And When this whole situation was described to the Chazon Ish, he said, you know what? I can cut down the 5 days to 4 days. He found a way that we could do that. Okay, so you cut it down from 5 days to 4 days. Does that really have an impact? Again, it would probably increase in that case the statistical probability that she'll have it, that she'll be able to conceive, but not by much. You know, it's not going to really solve the problem. So that's another one of the issues that we face with regard to Hazra Malachut.
Does everybody say that would be a case of a Benita artificial?
Well, no, I'm just telling you what the issues are. And this is everything I'm telling to you, Reuven, is okay. Before Rav Moshe Feinstein.
Okay.
This is the pre Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Yaakov Breisch was worried about Nidus, and the Chazon Ish, and the Divrei Malkiel, who was also bothered by the trust, the credibility of the Rofe in this case, he was bothered by Hashchos Zera. These are some of the serious issues. All this is before Rav Moshe Feinstein. Now, if you take a look at the English pages that I gave you, let me just... what page number is the first page that I gave you? Because I don't have
46.
46, okay. If you take a look at page 46, you'll see a question here, which is about 10 lines down from the top. What was the basis for a Feinstein's lenient opinions? Okay. Now, let me explain. Where did Rav Moshe Feinstein break new ground, what I call a heroic responsa? As far as Hashchos Zera Levatol, as we saw, this dates back to the Marsham way before Rav Moshe Feinstein. The fact that there's no issue of Hashchos Zera, this is not Hashchosa, that's fine. And the Berzhana Rav got plenty of rabbis to agree with his opinion. That's way before Rav Moshe Feinstein. As far as the trust and the reliability, the credibility of the Rofe, things moved at the speed of light even before Rav Moshe Feinstein. And the, you know, the halachic deciders were already figuring out how we can guarantee that no hanky panky went on, and it's the Zera of the husband, and so forth and so on. So all of that problems pretty much are cleared away, except for one major problem. And that is a woman who desperately wants to mother a child, and there's simply no way that she can do it with her husband. Is there any way of the halacha bending and being lenient? First, we'll talk on behalf of her, then I'll get to him in a second. that she can be a mother of a child with another man's zera, someone other than a husband. Now Rav Moshe is playing with fire. Because now you're talking about issues of adultery, because of the fact that there's a mixture here between her egg and not her husband's egg, but rather another man's egg. There's an issue of yuchsin, who is the father of this child? And then there's another issue. Given the fact that, as we've described earlier, there are so many problems halachically that have to be resolved. We remember that the Marsham only allowed this because they were married for 10 years and they couldn't have children. If he's incapable of having a child, then what's the push? She's not obligated to have children. The mitzvah of having children is incumbent upon him. And if he has a problem, so he should pray to God, but that's about it. You know what I'm saying? There's no push. You know, when the halacha is going to bend over backwards to try to come up with a leniency in situations that are so complicated, then there's got to be some push. There's got to be some desperate situation here. So the first issue is, does the woman's desire to have a child, is that considered something so desperate that the halacha should really be flexible and bend over backwards in that situation? We know, for example, if a woman is married and her husband is lost, we don't know if he's alive or he's dead. We don't have his body. So the halacha is going to bend over backwards. We normally would need two witnesses to allow her to marry someone else. And yet, in certain cases, for an aguna, we're going to allow one witness, and even a witness who's not really a kosher witness, and so forth and so on. But that's because this woman can't get married. Here's a woman who's married, but she cannot, with her husband, have a child. Is this a desperate situation? Do we consider her anguish and her desire to have a child to be something that's so significant? And I say this because, I don't know if you'll be with me for the series, but part three of this series is about freezing eggs. So take, for example, a woman who is not married. She tried to get married and she wasn't successful. Unfortunately, there are so many women today who fit that category. Shall we encourage her to freeze her eggs? Well, first of all, she has to rob a bank, but let's say she has enough money to do this. It's not cheap. But let's say she can achieve that. So that's a whole other issue. But it very much touches on what I'm mentioning now. Does the halacha bend over backwards? Because there are a lot of issues with freezing eggs. For the sake of her tremendous desire to have a child. I don't know who's going to raise the child. She has to do that herself. She doesn't have a husband. That's a different issue. So that I leave for the third lecture. But right now, what about artificial insemination with all its problems, you know, with all the intricacies? And now you can introduce someone else's sperm. Comes along Rav Moshe with an unbelievable breakthrough. And again, no words can describe how much of a revolution this is. Says Rav Moshe, the issue of adultery, the issue of mamzerus, of a child that's born out of an illicit relationship, only applies if she would have a physical union with another man. It's got to be a sexual relationship. If it's not, then this is not adultery. The one who argued against this before, I mentioned before, a Breich, but in addition, and you all know the history, was the Satmar Rebbe. And the Satmar Rebbe claimed that he had a Ramban that would prove that adultery is any union between her ovum and another man other than the husband. It doesn't matter whether that union came about through an intimacy or it came about through an artificial insemination. In both cases, the sperm of another man other than a husband is being introduced to her ovum, and that itself is a violation of adultery. You begin to understand why the Satmar Rav was so opposed to Rav Moshe's tshuva that things got really out of hand. This was not, you know, a gentleman discussion, you know, on a low level, you know, low tone. This was like...
Which year?
This is already in the 1920s. This is before Rav Moshe's tshuvas were published. And at that point, the Satmar Rav was publishing tshuvas back in Europe. Maybe it was the 30s. And they were very low tide. You know, he was just telling us that this theoretical possibility of artificial insemination, it's against the halacha if you take a sperm from some other man, because that would be adultery. He didn't get vociferous, he didn't get angry about it. But many years later, when he wrote his tshuvas in America, after Moshe allowed the, again, when I say allowed, it's not a precise terminology. I have to be very careful what I say. We don't know that Rav Moshe actually allowed artificial insemination. We don't know of any case that came up. But the tshuvas of Rav Moshe seem to indicate that it's permissible. There's no adultery over here. And there's no mamzeris. The child that's born from this artificial insemination is not a mamzer. And this is something that the Satmar Rav couldn't tolerate. You're really tampering with the most serious violations. You know, adultery is one kind of avera for which a person has to give up his life. It's one of the three cardinal sins. Adultery is a capital crime. Adultery is something that goes against the entire essence of the Jewish nation. And here the Satmar Rav quotes the Ramban. Now, in order to see the Ramban, just hoping I photocopied this page. If not, you'll listen. The Ramban in his commentary on the Torah. Just trying to find this. Just give me a second. Just one second. There's a 50-page article here. Oh, it's on page 53. I don't think I gave you page 53, did I?
Yes.
I did? Great. So take a look at the bottom of page 53 for a moment. And you'll see indented a pasuk in the Parsha of Arayos, which we're going to read in Mirtz Hashem on Yom Kippur. It says, V'al eshes amisecha lo siten l'shachbacha l'zera. Thou shalt not lie carnally with thy neighbor's wife. And then it says, l'zera for seed. So Rabban, in his commentary on the Torah, points out that this word lezera is totally superfluous. The pasuk would have read very well without the words for seed. And the Rabban suggests, and this you'll see on page 54, that why is it that this adultery relationship is so abominable in the eyes of the Torah? And the answer is because we won't be able to know who is the father of this child. Right? A woman is a married woman. We're going to assume that the child is the child of her husband when she had this relationship. And it's not. This is the father of this child is another man. That's going to undermine the whole fabric of Yuchsin. And that's how the Ramban understands an extra word in the Torah. Says the Satmar Rebbe, that logic of the Ramban proves that in a case of artificial insemination from the zera of another man, this is adultery, because adultery is lezera. Adultery means when we're mixing up the zera, we don't know who is the father of this zera. And when the Satmar Rav published this very harsh tshuva, he never mentions Rav Moshe by name, but against that position that would be liberal, allowing hazra'a malachutit, artificial insemination, and he quotes this Ramban, so Moshe felt the need to defend himself. And he says the Ramban is not a source for halacha. The Ramban is just telling you some sort of human understanding or human idea as to why the Torah is so opposed to adultery. But it's not a principle that you operate with it on a halachic level. Now, how does Rav Moshe know that adultery only applies when there is an intimate relationship, a normal relationship? So Rav Moshe knows this from a Gemara about Ben Sira. Ben Sira, according to the Gemara, was the son of Yirmiyo HaNavi. What happened? Some of the Zerah of Yirmiyo was somehow got into a warm bath. And a woman who is the mother of this Isi, she went bathing in the bath and she became impregnated. And the Gemara doesn't say that that's adultery. Rabbeinu Peretz, one of the great Balei HaTosfos, says that the child that was born to this relationship, this Ben Sira, was not in any way considered a mamzer. And Rabbeinu Peretz writes, and he's quoted by the Taz, the reason why he's not a mamzer is because this was not a relationship that she had with, you know, outside of marriage. This was a result of ambatya, of going swimming in a pool. Now, it's mind-boggling that Rav Moshe found a source which is written 1700 years ago that addresses artificial insemination, because this case where she went into a bath and she became pregnant, that's exactly what artificial insemination is all about. So if you have page 40, do you have page 48? Again, I don't remember exactly. I should pick.
We have
48.
I think it's in Avodah Zarah, if I'm not mistaken. You'll take a look on page 47, but now I want to show you something interesting on page 48. Rav Moshe says that if you look in a book called Otzer HaPoskim, you will find that there are a number of poskim who, based on this calculation and analysis of the Gemara about Ben Sira, allowed artificial insemination. Notice they claim this is not adultery, this is not mamzerus. And even though you may come to the conclusion that this only represents a minority of the authorities, but nevertheless, since we have a great need, we're allowed to rely on the minority of these poskim, that they're very fine and reputable poskim. Now, once Rav Moshe came to the conclusion that adultery is only a result of a sexual union between a woman and another man outside of marriage, then Rav Moshe writes the following. He says, for example, the husband is allowed to continue marrying, to be married to her. Normally, if a woman has a relationship with another man and she becomes pregnant, he, even if she doesn't become pregnant, but he has to divorce her. In this case, he doesn't have to divorce her because there was no adultery relationship. Furthermore, he says that any child that's born to this artificial insemination from another donor other than the husband, that child has a perfect status in Yuchsin. Because what happens if a non-Jew has a relationship with a Jewish woman? The child of that relationship is a Jew. Not only that, he goes even a step further. He says, let's say that as a result of the artificial insemination, she gave birth to a girl, and now this girl wants, when she grows up, she wants to marry a Kohen. The answer is, she can marry a Kohen. Because there's no pgam here whatsoever, there's no blemish. The only blemish would be if the guy had a sexual relationship with a Jewish woman. The child of such a relationship would not be allowed to marry Cohen. But in this case, there was no such a relationship, illicit relationship. Then if you take a look on page 49, Rav Moshe says that even if she would do this without consulting with her husband, she had no agreement or approval of her husband, even so, says Rav Moshe, he can still remain married to her. The only thing is he doesn't have to support the child because it's not his child. It came from another donor. If he agreed that she could become pregnant from another donor because he can't make her pregnant, then in such a case, as far as financial support is concerned, he takes that responsibility upon himself. So this is Rav Moshe's really far-reaching tshuva. The child is kosher. There's no adultery relationship here. There's no mamzerus. And not only that, but as we'll soon see, there's no grounds for any prohibition, except for one. The one prohibition that we might have is that, you know, we might not be able to clarify who the father of the child is. Well, if the donor is a non-Jew, it's irrelevant, because a non-Jewish man that has a relationship with a Jewish woman is not considered yuchsin. In other words, the child of such relationship is not related to the non-Jewish donor. The real problem would be if you had a Jewish donor other than the husband. Now you have a real serious problem as to know who is the father of the child. Now you're really messing around in a very complicated way. But leaving out that case, let's talk about a non-Jewish donor for a moment. Rav Moshe was asked the following question. Normally, if a woman might become pregnant from another man other than her husband, then the husband has to be porish, meaning he's not allowed to have a relationship with her for a 3-month period of time, because it takes 3 months until we can know whether she's pregnant or not. And that's called havchana in the Talmudic language. So the halacha is built in such a way that we have to know who the father of the child is. Now, it is possible, although the medical people deny this possibility, but it's possible that she became pregnant from her husband. So if she takes a donor sperm, how do we know who the father is? Maybe her husband is the father of the child. So Moshe says, okay, for 3 months, he will have to abstain from having a relationship with her. 3 months before the procedure of the insemination. But now life becomes very complicated. Why? Because if she becomes pregnant and she has a child, then since this child is not his, right, meaning the husband's, then the law is that the husband is not allowed to have a relationship with her for a period of 2 years. Why? Because a woman usually nurses for 2 years. I mean, today maybe that's not the mitzvah, but that's the halacha.
Apologies for coming this late.
So Rav Moshe says the following, that this halacha, that he has to abstain from having relations with her for 2 years, that's called a gzeira d'rabbanan. A gzeira d'rabbanan means it's a rabbinic enactment. And one of the principles with regard to rabbinic enactment is milsad lo shchicha lo gazru be'rabbanan, that in very unusual cases or circumstances, that gzera, that enactment, doesn't apply. So Moshe says an artificial insemination is a very unusual kind of circumstance. It's a milsad lo shchicha, it's not common. And therefore this rabbinic requirement that he separated from her for 2 years doesn't apply. Another tremendous leniency of Moshe. Moshe, by the way, uses that logic in other tshuvas whenever he comes up with an unusual situation. And he says, well, if you talk about gzeira d'rabbanan, then we're not going to apply the gzeira d'rabbanan in that unusual situation. Now, as I told you at the outset, this series of response of Moshe Feinstein regarding artificial insemination generated a tremendous controversy. There were two people at the head of the controversy, you know, opposing Rav Moshe. One, as I mentioned before, was the Satmar Rav, and the other, who is much more of a middle-of-the-road kind of posting that's accepted by everyone, you don't have to be a Satmar Chassid, is Rav Yaakov Breitsch. And he authors a book called Chelkas Yaakov, which again is one of the most reliable sources for final halacha that we have. He was one of the greatest and most reliable accepted poskim in the 20th century.
Where did he live? What's
he lived in Switzerland. And he writes the following. Now take a look, if you have, amongst the pages that I photocopied for you. Page 49. On the top of page 49, you get the sort of the gist a little bit in a summarized form of the opposition to Rav Moshe. He writes the reaction to these halachic statements of Rav Moshe Feinstein was vehement and heated. Rav Breitsch writes about artificial insemination, again this is a translation from the Hebrew, that is an act that is abominable, forbidden, disgusting, and grounds for divorcing a woman against her will. And he says, a child that was born through another donor, other than her husband, in artificial insemination, is a mamzer. I mean, he holds, like the Satmarov, that there's mamzerus even outside of the physical union. Now, at one point he says, we have to determine whether the child is a mamzer or not. And he says that Rav Moshe is relying totally on one of the Bali Atosis called Rabbeinu Peretz, who says that the child is acceptable. Says Rav Breish, who says that we rely on Rabbeinu Peretz? Where are the other Rishonim? You know, Rav Moshe Feinstein found one Rishon, and he builds an entire castle, an entire case about an artificial insemination based on one Rishon? How can we do such a thing? Then Rav Breish comes up with a whole nother argument. And this you'll see on page 51. He says that to allow artificial insemination, this is a chilul Hashem, a desecration of the name of God. And he quotes a number of Gemaras in Chulin. The Gemara says that we don't eat things that technically you're allowed to eat because the goyim don't want to eat it. And if the goyim find it detestable, then we're not allowed to eat it because they'll make fun of the Jews by saying that they allow certain things which we consider disgusting. And he says that the Gentiles, the church, has issued its view on artificial insemination, and they oppose it absolutely, straight across the board. It would be denigrating to the Jewish religion if we were to permit that which in the eyes of the Gentiles is absolutely forbidden, it's unethical. And basically the church was saying that if the couple can't have children, that's the divine will, and you have to live with that. We're not going to allow artificial insemination. The church was opposed, they condemned artificial insemination because they were afraid of the repercussions, you know, it could get out of hand and we don't know who's related to who. And that you'll see on page 52, he comes to the conclusion that since the Pope and the Catholic Church have condemned artificial insemination, it would be denigrating to Judaism to be more lax and consider something which they consider unethical, and we're going to allow it, we're going to permit it. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes an entire tshuva to disagree with Rav Breish on this point. And he says the following. He says that we have to change our religion because of the goyim. They have their religion, and lahavdil, we have our religion. If the goyim come to the conclusion that something is immoral, and we can prove that it's moral, then we don't have to change the Jewish religion because of the goyim.
Like Shkita, for example. Today, most of the world thinks Shkita is immoral, and we do it because we
correct. And that's an excellent example. We don't have to say that what they decide based on their religious principles is going to have an impact on us. Now, again, as I said, this is a whole other approach of Rav Breish. But basically, if you'll take a look at pages 52. Till 54, you'll see a summary of Rav Breish's conclusions. And one of them is based on the concept of chalitza. So if a woman is married, her husband dies and he leaves no children, she cannot marry, and he has a brother, she cannot marry anyone until she gets what's called chalitza, to relieve her of the mitzvah of yibum. Are we familiar with that? I don't have to go into great detail about that. Says Rav Moshe, if a woman has children through artificial insemination, usually the couple is going to keep that quiet. They don't want to publicize the fact that she became pregnant from another donor. And therefore, she's not going to want to come for chalitza. Because if she comes for chalitza, then she's in a sense publicly admitting that this is not the child of her husband. If it was the child of her husband, then she would not need chalitza. But she's gonna cover over the fact that this child is not her husband's child, and therefore she's gonna refuse to show up for chalitza. As a result, she's gonna violate many, many, many isurim. He says, what about a child that's born, that's conceived through artificial insemination in a Jewish donor? Now, what happens is, it's going to mess up the laws of chalitza again. Why? Because since this child was conceived through artificial insemination, he's really not the brother of the deceased husband. Because according to Rav Reish, since he came from a different zera, I don't need Rav Reish for that, but since he came from someone else's zera, he's not a brother to the person who died. And now we're going to assume that, the people are going to assume that he's the brother of the deceased. They're going to go through a mitzvah of yibum or of chalitza, when in fact he's not the brother of the deceased. And Rav Reish is giving example after example of how dangerous it is to allow artificial insemination. On page 53, he says, the overwhelming importance of absolute certainty of paternity, we have to know who the father is constantly affirmed in Jewish law. And therefore, if she becomes pregnant from another person's zera, then we're going to require that her husband refrain from having relations with her, as we discussed earlier. Then finally, he quotes the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who absolutely opposes artificial insemination.
You mean supplement?
I meant to say the Sapa Rebbe. I forgot what I said.
You said Moshe Feinstein.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant to say Rav the Sapa Rebbe. Now, what I'd like to show you here, again, I wasn't able to photocopy all these pages, but in the Nishmas Avram, by the way, look at the size of this book, and a great percentage of it is dedicated to artificial insemination. He writes the following. If we take the zera of the husband, which as we said before is a lot less problematic than taking the zera of another man because she's a married woman, and we're going to solve all the issues of Hashchasa zera and we're going to rely on the rofe and so forth and so on, now he asks the following question. Is the Baal, the husband, considered the father of the child? And he says the following. I'm just going to read for this page 18. You only have pages 11 and 12. But on page 18 he writes that there's a tshuva the Maril. He's one of the late Rishonim, early Achronim. And he writes that based on Ben Sira is considered the son of Yirmiyahu. Again, Ben Sira's mother was married to another man. But she went into this bath and she was impregnated by the seed of Yirmiyah. And the Maril says that Ben Sira is considered, according to Jewish law, to be the son of Yirmiyah, even though Yirmiyah had no relationship with Ben Sira's mother, right? Because she was impregnated by the Zera in the Yambatya. And he goes on to quote another tshuva. And let's say, for example, the Gemara says that a woman should not sleep on sheets where another man slept in those sheets, because the Gemara says that maybe she'll be impregnated by the zera that's on the sheet. Again, I don't know biologically if this is possible, but anyway. And if she becomes impregnated by that zera, then we may make a mistake and think that her husband is the father of this child, when in fact it's the person whose zera was left on the sheet, he's the husband of the child. So therefore, we see clearly, and this is codified in many, many different responses. He has the Tashbetz and the Turi Eben and the Orech Laner, a whole list. Anyway, the list is not important, but the bottom line is that we see that the Vlad is Kari Beno, that the child is considered the son of the balazer, of the person whose seed impregnated his mother. And that means that the yuchsin is to the father. Now, he goes on to say that in such a case, we solve a lot of the problems that could arise in artificial insemination if we could only, again, this all depends upon the medical situation. What is the problem? If the problem is that for some reason through a normal sexual union, the zera is not reaching its goal and impregnating the ovum of the woman, if that's the issue, and we can solve that problem through artificial insemination, then we really have a smooth approach here. What do I mean? We can solve all the problems. We can solve the problem of Hashkosa Zera because we have the breakthrough tshuva of the Birjana Rav that it's not considered Hashkosa because it's done for the purpose of having a child. We're going to solve the problem of reliability on the Rofe. And now we're going to solve any possible Yuchsin issues because we've now concluded that this child is the child of his father, the father who's the Bala Zera. So this is a wonderful approach. Now again, in the initial tshuvas, this was just a fantasy. You know, nobody actually believed that this technique would become reality. Now, at the first stage, relying on Rav Moshe's tshuvas and many tshuvas before him, they allowed artificial insemination from the husband. Rav Moshe had a problem. He felt that the zera should be taken from the husband after intercourse. It should be collected in the tube after intercourse. Why? Because he didn't want what's called hashchasa biyadayim. He didn't want the man to have to masturbate and remove the zera. So therefore he felt that the husband and wife should have a relationship and then they would collect the zera from her body. So Rav Moshe asked the following question: how is that going to happen? You know, you need the physician or the technician to take the zera collected immediately while the zera is still alive and well. And Rav Moshe here writes a tshuva that he's absolutely opposed to allowing this couple to have that relationship in the physician's office, even if they would lock themselves up in an office, you know, in a room in the general office. He says that's a violation of the laws of tznius. Later poskim said that that's not a violation of tznius because they're only doing this for the sake of having a child. They're not doing it for immodesty. You know, if you do something that's immodest, you know, you have a public sexual act, that's immodesty. But here it's being done in the most modest way possible for the sake of having a child. But Rav Moshe in his tshuvas was absolutely opposed to it. He said you're going to have to find another method in which the zera is going to be collected. And as I said, we have no record that Rav Moshe ever actually allowed in any real situation an artificial insemination. But what I'm trying to convey to you is the following. Once the path was clear halachically to be lenient in the case of the husband being the donor, then in cases where she could not conceive through her husband and her husband could not impregnate him, let's assume that he and she agree that they would raise a child that's not his child because it was an artificial insemination from another donor. And let's say we can solve the yuchsin problem because the donor is a guy. So in that case, since Rav Moshe says there's no issue of adultery because it's not through a sexual union with another man, there's no issue in the status of the child as far as being kosher, and if it's a girl, she can even marry a kohen. We've solved all the problems of Hashkosa Zera. We're not going to rely on a Ramban because the Ramban is only a philosophical point, it's not a halachic point. We're not going to say, like Rav Reich would say, that there's a Chil Hashem here because the Goyim, the Pope is opposed to artificial insemination. You begin to see how halacha is now moving forward towards a position in which artificial insemination could be sanctioned even from a foreign donor, again under certain strict conditions. Okay, so I see it's time for Myriv. Let me just take this opportunity to thank everyone for coming. And if you get a chance to take home this literature and read it on your own, the Hebrew is more important, but you know that depends upon how well you do in reading the Nishras Avram. But once again, I want to thank everyone for coming. And we'll have the next shiur will be, I think, on Wednesday of next week.